Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days. I mean, days
I feel like the waterfall of thoughts. Every now and then, a nice calm.
Can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City,
the Shambhala New York podcast.
Yes, this is episode 94 of the podcast. I am Dave, your host, as always, for the 94th time, welcoming you to the podcast. Hey, spring is here. Spring is just beginning. The birds are singing. Love is in the air. That new person at the office, the mysterious foreign student who just joined your class, your therapist. This is the time when budding love begins to take root and form the fluttering in the heart that we all love so much. And to guide us through this, I thought this would be a good time to present Shastri Ethan Nichtern's talk from Valentine's Day, from about 6 weeks ago. This was a talk about true love, romance, desire, how to navigate it, what does it all mean, does meditation help, or just make it the whole thing worse because you're more aware of what's going on? These are interesting questions. But before we get to that, I do want to mention that the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York is presenting its introductory course on meditation. It's called Meditation in Everyday Life. It's a great course if you haven't experienced it before. It's a 5-week course after which you will have learned everything you need to start your own home practice. Meditation in Everyday Life is a weeknight course beginning Thursday, April 7th, and following on for 5 weeks. For more information and to register, go to ny.shambhala.org and click the link on the homepage for Meditation in Everyday Life. And now, Shastri Ethan Nichtern, as you know, is the author of many books, including The Road Home, A Contemporary Exploration of the Buddhist Path. And this was a great talk from our weekly Dharma gathering the week of Valentine's Day last month. Here is Ethan Nichtern.
There's probably no two people in this room who are in quite the same place with what desire and love mean for you, although we probably share a lot of experiences. There might be some people in this room who are trying to mindfully figure out dating apps. Tinder or Grindr or any of the new ones that end in "-er," that I'm not aware of. Some of us might be trying to figure out whether it's time to take the next step with someone. Some of us might be trying to figure out whether it's time to take the next step and end it with someone. Some of us might be trying to figure out what the next step is when you've been together so long that it seems like all your steps are repetitive. Some of us might be trying to figure out how to grieve desire. Some of us might be completely cynical about the whole thing, and we might be in multiple of the categories. And are there what other categories might there be? Anyone? Anything that didn't feel touched on by what I just said? It's not the safest question to ask because it's a very high likelihood that whatever your answer is what your situation is right now. But I think that the key way to start this conversation and a way to make it, and what I really appreciate about the Buddhist teachings, the Shambhala teachings, is it starts with what is universally human and how that universally human thing might then be applied in different situations for different specific human beings or sentient beings. So I think what is universally human here is that it's a discussion of desire, love, and things in that arena, which is, I think, just spiritually, psychologically, desire is probably one of the most misunderstood things that has happened to every human being ever, which is kind of tragic. I think a lot of times people misunderstand what Buddhism, either ancient Buddhism or modern Buddhism, has to say on the topic. Desire is the cause of suffering. If you hear anyone say that, please tell them Ethan Nickturn wants to talk to them. But there is, I think, one of the reasons this is so misunderstood is there's very definitely, I think we would all agree, because it looks like a room of very smart people who've lived your own experiential lives to whatever point we've lived them, but I think we would all agree that desire is at least, it's a conundrum, at least. It's a riddle, it's a tension, it's a pain sometimes. It causes harm sometimes. It causes sadness. It's awesome sometimes. It gets you out of bed in the morning sometimes. It gets you in bed sometimes. But it's from the standpoint of being a sentient being, I think if we really went back to the root, desire is so interesting because there's, in any moment of desire, I was thinking about this, there's this feeling that there's something we want that is not us. Which is, I mean, it's such a beautiful moment, because what I was thinking about is at least you're paying attention to a larger world in desire, you know? I mean, we can talk about how you're not paying attention to the larger world because you get caught and fixated, but in desire, there's this idea of like, oh, there is other. A lot of times the way the founder of our tradition, Chogyam Trungpa, talked about these things, where it was almost like he had a way of talking about human psychology and spirituality that was almost like, I don't know if any of you ever read like Dallaire's Book of Greek Myths, but just like going back to the root of how did this all start? And some feeling entity looked beyond themselves and said, whoa, you or that, right? So we're really more focusing tonight on the you than the that, right? We're not really focusing on the ice cream level of desire. We're focusing on the other being in some kind of, well, right, Cupid wasn't talking about making friends, right? Which is interesting, because there is kind of a Cupid of friendship, which I'm also very interested in. Like, how does Cupid shoot his, her, their arrow at a friend and say, you're going to be my best friend for all of first grade? Or for all of our 40th to 70th years together? Right, that's a kind of Cupid moment, but it's a different moment. So we're really focusing on the other and the relationship to other. That's, I want to communicate with you in a certain way. And the whole conundrum here is that on the one hand, I'm humble and aware enough to realize that there's something interesting that's not me. There's someone interesting that's not me. But on the other hand, is really now has to go into some kind of chase for what that is. And there's all, this is where classic Buddhist teachings focus, is like all the potential things that can go wrong with the chase. Sometimes this is really good to just watch nature shows for this, right? Just, so what's one thing that can go wrong? One, I mean, and this is the Tinder grinder level of things. One thing that can go wrong is you want the other, they don't want you. Classic Buddhism says that is one way that suffering can happen. Right? Another version of that, I'm sure many of us are familiar with this pain. The other wants you, you don't want the other. So there's all that. How do you work with that? Then there's the problem, the other does want you. And this is the interesting problem to me. Once you get the other, they're not quite the same anymore as when you didn't have them. Something about that perspective shift has created a new kind of desire relationship, right? Which is, this is, so now you don't want what you have, or it's changed, or you have to find a way to want it, them, differently. Any other big problems with wanting the other, getting, not wanting the other? Right, so wanting the other, you still want them, is maybe, but it's not good for, it's not healthy or harmonious or, right? And it's interesting. There is a classic Buddhist teaching that says, at the same time as we are meant to expand compassion for all beings, including the annoying person, including the difficult person, that in terms of who is close to you, there's a teaching on how to be a compassionate being that says, if somebody makes your positive qualities increase, draw them in. If they don't, it might be better to wish compassion from afar. So then the question is, what are my positive qualities? And, you know, there's, I think for all of us, there's probably different moments in life when, you know, I've had a few moments when I said, you know what I really want to cultivate now is self-destructiveness. I want to see what that feels like. So I'm going to draw you in. I'm reading. I was studying Buddhism, right? I actually was reading in my arc the 37 Practices of Bodhisattva about the same time the movie Swingers came out. And the Buddhist text said, draw them in if they increase your positive qualities. And I said, okay. Let's play around with what this feels like if I'm trying to cultivate more fun, right? That's interesting. At certain parts of your life, and I think maybe classic spirituality doesn't always honor this shadow side, the quality we're actually looking, we're intending to cultivate, is not necessarily a Thich Nhat Hanh, Amma, Care Bear kind of love. So there's another interesting element of this is, like, what is your intention and is what you're cultivating related to your intention? And it's hard to question someone's intention. I mean, you could say your intentions are stepping on my toes, right? You could say, I know you want to make $50 billion, but that means other people don't eat. So that's one way, but it would be hard to question someone's intention when they say, yeah, I want to have a very hedonistic life. It's like, well, then I hope you cultivate that, and I hope it doesn't harm anyone else. And if that's possible, more power to you. Turns out, I don't think it's possible. But, so, This is really interesting, and I'm always really fascinated by that, the particular one where, and this is why desire is such a tricky thing, is that even if desire is satisfied, it's not satisfied. Because if desire is based on appreciating something that is not you, appreciating the other, even if it's satisfied, which means some kind of union with the other, the relationship between self and other switches in that, which means if the mind is just is addicted to the otherizing, it's going to suffer. And this is where I think ancient Buddhist texts get very shoddily translated as desire is the cause of suffering, because it's, if you are playing with desire and you don't understand that the process of satisfying desire is not actually going to give you what you desired, it's going to give you this new thing called union, you're going to suffer. This is something Buddhism talked about. This is something Western psychological thinkers talked about, sometimes in much more difficult to understand terms, like Jacques Lacan talks about this in a way that you could never understand unless your friend, who's both a Buddhist psychologist and a Lacanian expert, explains it to you, which is how I came to understand that, right? People are talking about, like, this is a problem. We don't really talk about this, and, like, there's no lecture on this. Like, this is not the user agreement before using Tinder, right, or Match.com. Like, do you understand that if this person that you're just experiencing as an other actually decides they want to hang out with you, they are not going to be the same person anymore, by the definition of how subject-object relationships work? If so, swipe away. So this is the kind of basic conundrum. And I think maybe a lot of us work with that conundrum because that can happen in phases, right? And there's always, in any kind of relationship, friendship, family, romance, coworker that goes on for a while, there's a dance between union and separateness, right? And if we're kind of awake in the whole thing, there's no suffering. The hard part is the whole thing is really intense, and it tends to be, this is why we try to meditate when it's quiet, that it tends to be a little easier to be awake when it's a little less intense. And this is why I think the monastic and celibate traditions arose in various spiritual traditions, because they said, it's not just that you need a silent retreat, you also, if you want to wake up, you need a break from the intensity of this dance of desire. So now, this is what's very profound to me about the Shambhala teachings, is it's a body of teachings, although we do have some monastic practitioners, it's a body of teachings that celebrates this notion of being awake in the world. So it's now saying you're going to dance with desire in an intense way, in your own way, but in a way that has to start to wake up to this back and forth between wanting the other, getting it, not getting it, being wanted by some other that you don't want, changing over time, changing what the other is, changing what the union is. So there's a conundrum here. There's a conundrum that we need to be, and that's why developing loving kindness is, if you don't go into that conundrum with gentle intentions towards yourself and others, you're probably going to cause harm. And if you're anything like me, you probably have caused harm, and that's the other thing about these teachings is it's okay to cause harm. There's never been a sentient being who didn't cause harm, even the ones who woke up. So the other thing I always think about desire when it moves into the sort of Valentine's space, which is what's coming up, is that there's a need to work with these two extreme approaches. And traditionally in Buddhism, they are called eternalism, or sometimes theism, and nihilism. And I think when you get a group of people into the room where there's a declared day of the year that is desire and romance day, you get these sort of, these are our, from a Buddhist standpoint, this is the two-party system, actually. There's the eternalists who are like, I love Valentine's Day. I feel so happy. What are you telling me? Desire is suffering. Didn't you see that movie where they do? I know my friend who's in the other party says this is bullshit, but no, you can. There is a Prince Charming. There is a Princess Buttercup. It exists. And then there's your friend who's I don't know, in the two-party system how this maps on. You can play with which is which. They're both confused from a Buddhist standpoint. But then there's your friend sitting next to you that's just like face-palming. I'm going to this poetry reading called Anti-Valentine's Day, and we are going to just deconstruct. It's not even going to be a witty deconstruction. That was 2 years ago. It's just going to be like a bludgeoning, simplistic, aggressive deconstruction of this bullshit notion of soulmate and true love. And I like the fact that when you actually kind of get into how the mind works, those aren't really two separate people. It's like almost two voices in your own. I don't know where. Maybe one voice is here, maybe the other voice is here. I don't know. But Chogyam Trungpa, when he was talking about Buddhism, he talked about it as a non-theistic tradition, which is not the same thing. He specifically chose not to call it an atheistic tradition. So when he's talking about theism, which often means deity, he's really talking about savior. And this notion of the Prince Charming or Prince Stud Muffin, which would be the corollary of Princess Buttercup, I think. This notion that there's going to be, I mean, obviously we're just making it very caricatured, but we all have been in this space, I think. I mean, you might not have used the term soulmate in your life, but I think if you've been in a relationship that ended and your first feeling during that period of grief was, I'm nothing without them, I'm totally screwed, I'm totally alone, that means your savior has left, right? So that means you were in this arena of like looking for some external thing to make you permanently okay. And this is called either eternalism or theism. And in some ways, this definition of theism, if we applied it to spirituality, it only really applies to a very fundamentalist notion of God. So I don't think that was the real application of what he was talking about when he said this is a non-theistic tradition. I think he was talking about for each practitioner in modern society to look at the ways that our mind gets caught in this thing, this entity, this being, this person is going to make me okay. This not me has the power to save me. So this is what we call a rom-com, romantic comedy. It always has this structure of salvation at the end. And, you know, there are some slightly ironic rom-coms, but there's always this sense of like, we kind of paid lip service to the idea that you're cool on your own. But at the end, it was really this other person and the fact that we could close the door, right? The problem with the rom-com is really that the relationship is just beginning. In every rom-com that's ever been, it ends at the beginning. It ends where it gets interesting. And this is the problem with a stuck storyline about relationships is they usually don't really cover the interesting part. So I do think we live in an era, even if you're going to the anti-Valentine's poetry reading in your heart or in the external world known as Brooklyn. I bet there's like 20 in Brooklyn. I bet 4 are in Bed-Stuy, 6 are in Bushwick, 1 is in Park Slope. Even if you're going to that place, I think it's really worth acknowledging how much our mind gets caught thinking like this new thing is going to make me okay. And what Trungpa Rinpoche said is that's not the point of a relationship. That's not a point of a friendship. That's not the point of having a spiritual teacher. At best, what those things can do and what we should honor them for is reminding us and setting a good support structure for reminding us that we are fundamentally okay. That's why you need good relationships in your life, is because they remind you what you already are, not that they make you something else. So I think this is, you know, what I was going to say a moment ago is, I do think we still live, even if you're going to that anti-Valentine's poetry reading, in a very romantically theistic society. And here's why. If we didn't, weddings would be cheaper. That's my personal. They are looking to take advantage of, as someone who's co-planning a wedding, of that idea that you can be held hostage by your desire, that this day isn't just going to be a celebration of a relationship, isn't just going to be a commitment to working with bringing out each other's basic goodness, but it is going to be the day that saves you. And that's the premium. Oh, this is for a wedding? Now let's go to the other side of the coin, the nihilism. Right? It's been actually Marissa and I who are here tonight, we've been talking to a lot, I have been and we have been talking to a lot of people kind of getting elder advice about marriage, you know? And it's interesting because some of the, and I haven't figured out this in dharmic terms yet, but some of the people who say the most nihilistic stuff about long-term relationships are the ones who are still in the longest relationships. And I haven't figured out how that works. I've talked to people who've been married for 30 years and just are like, seem to have lost all of the sense of romance and dance, or at least they don't talk about that part. It's like, yeah, sometimes when he goes away, I just remember how happy I am. But it's great, but it's great. You'll love it, right? Does anyone feel this way, that you're in a long-term relationship and it's kind of something about your nihilism or your skepticism or your anti-Valentines that actually helps the relationship? I think there is, yeah, yeah. I think there is a Buddhist component here, because if there was a side of these two that you wanted to lean on, maybe if you were trying to figure out like how to find that middle, but you can't ever exactly find the middle, leaning a little towards the, this is never going to work, you never get what you want, the dance is a fantasy, it just gets you into the mess. Leaning towards that side, I think, makes you skeptical, which there is a kind of realism in that skepticism. But I really think, watching the world today, I really think it's a slippery slope. There is a lot of nihilism in the world right now on my Facebook page that is masquerading as realism, and it's hard to call it out because it's like, no, that's not pragmatic to say this is the best we can do. It's not pragmatic to say that every long-term partnership, you get happy when the person leaves you alone. There's something painful in that, and it's almost a suffering that's been frozen over time that people call pragmatic. Go along to get along, right? So this is interesting, because with any middle path, there's a kind of, it's a dynamic balance. It's not like you find that space of, I love you because you remind me that I'm okay on my own. Sometimes it's like, this Prince Charming shit is crap. And other times it's like, no, I want to believe. Give me something to believe in. let's watch The Princess Bride again. I'm writing my next book about that, so that's on my mind. Let's, yeah, true love. True love, the one thing worth. And I do think if I had to, humanity as a whole, and they've demonstrated this through neuroscience, is towards the nihilism end of the spectrum, just in terms of the way we apprehend the present moment. So it's good to be a romantic Buddhist. The Buddhist part is kind of the realism, and the romance is kind of the hopefulness and aspiration. And where does this aspiration lead to? And this is really, I think, the point of working with desire and cultivating love, which is what we did in our meditation practice tonight, leaning into it, saying, I could open my heart more. Maybe not right now, but I could actually wish more happiness for beings I'm attracted to, for beings I'm already in relationship to, for beings who've helped me, for people I don't even know, for people I've never even thought about empathizing with. Right? We could lean into it, but we also have to love specifically. There's actually no way to love all beings, is what I've found out. Most of the time that people say, oh yeah, may all beings be happy, if they haven't gone through the step of, who has taught me about loving kindness? And hasn't gone through the really difficult step of, may I have happiness? And the step of, may my beloved people have happiness? And may that person who I don't even know and don't even understand their situation have happiness. And if the person hasn't gone through the step of, may Donald Trump have happiness, when we say, may all beings have happiness, it's what one Buddhist psychologist called a spiritual bypass. It's a way to universalize, to avoid the pain, the difficult yoga of working with the specific. And I really think the dance of desire with specific people in whatever way is meaningful to you, in whatever way your intention moves you, becomes really powerful if the specificity of it does begin to open you up to all beings, because that's not a bypass. If working with the sort of, and this is, I also heard a Buddhist psychiatrist say this once, that the tragedy, if you look at our evolutionary biological makeup, is that human beings go everywhere looking for love, meaning looking to receive it, and the human nervous system, human heart, human mind are the best machine that this planet and maybe this solar system and maybe this galaxy have ever seen for actually generating love. And if we could use our specific relationships to start to expand and universalize, then romance is completely a way to help all beings. And that's the idea, is the specific opens to the universal. The universal just sometimes can just avoid the specific. And I'm sure we've all heard in some yoga class or some Buddhist class, if you've been there, the person dedicate the merit and be like, may all beings have happiness. And then the next person they interacted with, there was a closed heart. This happens to me all the time. I'm not talking about other teachers. I'm sure you've all seen me do this. And that means that we're working in the wrong direction. We have to start with each being and then build to all beings, which is why the loving kindness practice takes us through that cycle each time. So that's all I have to say. I hope it was helpful. I hope one of you writes a Buddhist romantic comedy, figures out that riddle. Groundhog Day was kind of close to it. But what's on your mind? Thoughts, questions, insights, disagreements? wisdom, confusion.
You think that desire could more or less be alleviated when we take ourselves out of the equation. When you started the talk or orientation, you said, like, let's take the you and the other. Mm-hmm. And let's separate them. Mm. And I think somehow when we talk about desire, and I think in this case we're talking about desire for other people, and or, you know, in that case, I think we are having expectations about that person that has a lot to do with us.
Right.
And I think some of the disappointment comes when we've, you know, come in and we find out that it was something different.
Right.
And if we just love people the way we love tortilla, like, it's just a tortilla, that's it. Like, it tastes good, it may taste, but it's the tortilla. And we don't expect anything else but whatever that is. Do you think that can help,
right,
in that sense?
So I think I understand what you mean by taking yourself out of the equation, which is actually part of these loving kindness and compassion practices. There's actually a feeling of, it's not actually, you're not able to do this. I tried to talk about this a little bit in The Road Home. You're not actually able to experience the other person's perspective, but you just try kind of, what might they be feeling? You know, as a way to empathize, just as a way to use your own experience and what you know in your own experience to say, what could it possibly be? And it's just that exercise of trying to contemplate the other person's experience, which I think is a moment of taking yourself out of the equation, right? So the contemplation is not, how can I make you happy? Or the even more kind of rudimentary contemplation of, how can you make me happy? It's, may you be happy, whether or not I'm involved. But I also think you never, because this is your practice in your life, which is the whole root of this dance with desire, you're already in the, saying, can I take myself out of the equation is almost like saying, can I take the equation out of the equation? Because it's our dance of desire that we're talking about, right? We're already here. So I do think empathy has this quality of taking oneself out of the equation, of at least trying to say, like, I'm looking at this from my perspective. What would it feel like? It's almost one of those stop motion cameras, right? What would it feel like if I flipped the perspective? And it's imaginative. It's always approximate, because you can't. I think sometimes people feel guilt or confusion. They're like, how do I know what Donald Trump is feeling? Which is a very valid point. Exceptionally valid point. But that's not the point of the practice. It's not the point that we know what the person is experiencing from their perspective. It's that we're even trying. But then at the end of it, you come back to, and maybe I have desire for you, or maybe I have aversion towards you, and that was the whole equation to begin with. So I think it's, you can temporarily do these practices to take oneself out of the equation. It's said that an enlightened person has actually taken self and other out of the equation. And but once one is in the equation, the other is in the equation. Once self is in the equation, the other is in the equation, and vice versa. That's the way dualistic perception works. But yeah, I hear what you're saying, but also you're the one trying to love. So you're in the equation.
Thank you. I have a question about creation and destruction, and you touched on feeling self-destructive, but I was thinking about what you were saying about the kind of breakdown in subject-object relations, mm-hmm. having a union, and then you then experience a sort of creativity together. You get this thirdness, which is, you know, what does that union kind of enable or create? The flip side of that, I think, is sometimes, well, I'm struggling. I'm wondering if you have any advice on feeling that you are unable to live up to the demands of love, or that mainly that, and then that becoming a kind of destructive, mainly self-destructive force. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
the demands of love, meaning once you're in that dance or a relational union, at least with someone, that there's a feeling of wanting to raise the bar, of wanting to be your best self for them, and then feeling like that's a lot to ask and I probably can't do it, so let's just go throw it all away. Let's go do something stupid.
Bluntly, yes.
I think also being
able to see the beauty and the potential of love can sometimes be quite crushing when you're unable to embody, when you can see that there it could be something that was so much your best self or mm-hmm. your best togetherness,
right.
And you're unable for whatever reason to sort of embody that. And that turning into a sort of an incapacity to even be present, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I can't say this for sure, but I think from my perspective, I know totally what I think you're talking about. And what I can relate it to is the path in general, because we're talking about the relational aspect of the path of awakening from this standpoint. And the path of awakening for me is full of moments where I see my actual potential. And it's there's a thought, and it might happen in meditation, it might happen when I'm just manifesting confidence, which is something these teachings talk quite a lot about and give tools for. And you really say, like, oh, wait, there is actually nothing different between me and the Buddhas of the three times, as the teachings say. There is actually nothing different between you and a completely awakened, realized being. And for a moment, you're there, right? And I imagine that's the same thing we feel like when it's at the peak of the eternalist mountain. There's this moment that we then fixate on of like, I've never felt so seen by a person, or I've never felt so respected by a person, or I've never felt so connected or so aware. And then a kind of more mundane, covered, confused, do something stupid reality comes back. Right, that's the weirdest thing in meditation, that you have like 5 minutes of like 360 degree embodied panoramic awareness, and it's almost like light is bursting out of your heart center in all directions, and then the next thought is, oh, I gotta call my mom, Jesus Christ. And there is nothing more heartbreaking than the contrast between those two experiences, because you're like, I don't want to feel that way. The Buddha you comes back in is like, can you believe what you just said about your mom? So romance has its own version of that, which is what I was calling the do something stupid. But I think that's what the whole path is moments of uplift. And then I think what we really need self-loving kindness for, and these teachings that we are basically good for, is to handle that contrast. So that it's okay to have those moments of total awakening or total union in the romantic sense, followed by stupid self-protectionism. And we're there's no fundamental mistake there. There's just a contrast that's revealing something to us about what our nature is, and then where we get stuck sometimes. And I think in some ways it's the doing it alone is actually simpler, because you don't have to coordinate the whole discussion with anyone else. But in other way, and I think that's why some of us are like, I don't want to have to explain that whole thing to someone else, or feel the vulnerability of that awakening followed by that dumb thought or that dumb action. But I think it's also really helpful to have someone else there who gets it and can be like, it's okay. Or, oh yeah, I think you just went from total Buddhahood to kind of selfish, insecure behavior, like pretty quickly. Did you notice that? So it's more complicated to have someone pointing that out to us, but if we can really establish tools and guidelines for practicing together, my experience is it's in any of these arenas, right? With student-teacher relationship, with sangha or community friendships, I think the thing about the romance and the partnership is that that person really gets to know you. So if the two people, or however many people in your version of it, really know each other well and really, that there's a trust that builds. You know, it's almost like the other person can start to become your awareness. You know, they can't ever replace that, because that would be theism. Like, oh, you're going to help me, right? But there's a mirroring, which, by the way, the human system is designed for mirroring and social interactions, right? Once libertarians study neuroscience, their entire philosophy is decimated. If Ayn Rand had studied contemporary neuroscience, she'd be done. We are geared to receive a sense of self from our relationship with others. So if that's a trusted, loving other, very powerful. The problem is it's so intense that it's easy to hide. And I think we also live in an age where there's a lot more freedom, which is great, and a lot more ability for us to define it, but there's also a lot less commitment in our age. And so I find it really helpful to commit to something. And you, it's kind of similar to the Buddhist commitments. Like, you say, I'm going to take this vow to work with my practice, like the refuge vow, or we have a vow called the Shambhala vow, because you're like, I know it's more helpful if I get married to this path, because it can hold me accountable and it can actually help me work with myself rather than be another burden or something I have to run from. Which is, I think, a little bit of the where the cynicism comes from, you know. And also, I think because I have to honor, because I haven't been there, that the cynics must have something going for them, because they know how to stick in it for the long haul, you know. So, yeah, I don't know. I think we all need to develop so much more compassion for our self-destructive behavior, because I think that's what it is. From in Buddhist terms, it's seeing the contrast between our true nature and our habitual patterns, and not being able to leave space for that contrast. And that's what self-destructiveness is.
Thank you.
Yeah, just quick question about what you just said at the end. You mentioned, like, Ayn Rand, if she only knew how much we gear to get some of our self-esteem from feedback from others.
All of it is what the neuroscience says. But then, it's all a relationship, but yeah.
But the whole beginning of the talk was about if we otherize others and we kind of, like, depend on them to save us, that's, like, the wrong approach. We set ourselves to disappointment. So how is it?
Right. Well, I think it's the... Chogyam Trungpa said that the purpose of any meditation practice is to make friends with yourself. Right, so I talked about this as accepting your own friend request. Right. That's chapter one of The Road Home. Meditation, accepting your own friend request. Not very original. It's just a student in the lineage of a brilliant man who has a Facebook account. That's what happened there. Accepting your own friend request, making friends with yourself. So if we don't have tools for doing that, in terms of how we're socially mirrored, what is our sense of self, right? It's what other people think of us. But there's a problem, which is that you can't know what other people think of you. So it's what you think other people think of you. That's your sense of self in a mirrored, not internally aware space. And then it's really what we're afraid other people think of us. So it's like 2 degrees away and one turn into, like, darkness and nightmare, really, is what our sense of self is without self-awareness. So if you have a way of saying, like, what do I feel? Not with all this, not separate from all this mirroring of social messaging, but actually just what is happening in my heart and mind right now, and how can I make a connection with it? Then you still have the interweaving, right? But you can also kind of start to have a little confidence in your own experience of yourself. So it's not one and it's not the other, right? We are self-aware, and our self-awareness is based on others in all kinds of different ways. It's the way I thought of saying it is that your sense of self is personally experienced but socially constructed. So the personally experienced part is why we need to look at our own minds regularly, repeatedly, again and again, so that we can increase that friendship and increase that familiarity and that sense of confidence in knowing ourselves really, not what we're, what we fear other people might be thinking about us. But this, but the socially constructed part is to realize that we are constantly bouncing understandings of what a human being is off of each other. Right. And so if we can actually cultivate mutually trusting relationships and make friends with ourselves, then we're working on awakening in at two ways at once. Right. I think Ayn Rand would have had something if she said you really need to get to know yourself. So that she would have had half the puzzle. Right. But half the puzzle isn't really the whole puzzle. But it's good. Sometimes it's good to say, I'm going to take responsibility for my own mind. I think that's, in some ways, that's what a meditation retreat is. Except then you do a group meditation retreat. And then it's really interesting to begin to see, doing one in Vermont, at the beginning of March, and a lot of it is silent, but it's amazing to see when a group of 40 or 50 people get together, practice together, mostly in silence, how much socializing actually is happening in that space. It's almost like a purer form of socializing because you're not gossiping and talking about the Kardashians to get in the way of everything, you know? It's like you're really seeing how people relate to one another when there's a loving container around that. So that's the tricky thing, is a lot of times people go on a group meditation retreat and they think, okay, this is my time to really take responsibility for me. You know, I'm going to sit under my Bodhi tree like the Buddha did, who was kind of, in some ways, he was kind of Ayn Randy, the historical Buddha. The Shambhala heroes are a little more Dr. King-esque. And I'm going to sit under the Bodhi tree on this retreat. And then the experience is like, wait, there's all these other people under my Bodhi tree. In my head, and eating with me. And first of all, who invited all the people in my head? And second of all, who invited all of you? So that's the thing. We have to make friends with ourselves, but we never meditate alone. So, and tonight we were just talking about the Valentine's implication of that. Okay, I hope this was helpful. Isn't it nice to practice with other people? Podcasts are great. Insight Timer is great. Headspace is great, but isn't this better? So let's keep it going. I hope to see you again soon.
Thank you, Shastri Ethan Nichtern. I hope to see you again soon. You hope to see all of us again soon, to hear us hearing you on the podcast, along with all of our other great podcast teachers and presenters. Visit us at ny.shambhala.org for more information about classes and weekend retreats. You can come to our weekend Dharma gathering in person and hear these talks live at the New York Shambhala Meditation Center in Manhattan, if you happen to live or work or play in the New York City area, every Tuesday night. Otherwise, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look us up. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. See you next time. Hear you. You hear me. Next time.